Hi again. I'm Sarah. Welcome. Thank you for coming today. I'm one of the editors of Triple Canopy, and we're a magazine and editorial collective. Today's event is part of our ongoing series here at PS1 called Speculations, The Future Is. It's our contribution to the museum summer exhibition, Expo One. It's 50 days of events, and we've asked writers and artists, technologists, scientists, and others to describe a future that they'd like to see realized, and then to ask what demands that future might make on the present day. So just quickly to mention some upcoming events. On July 4th, we'll have anthropologist David Graeber in conversation with the intellectual historian Gopal Balakrishnan, talking about innovation and stagnation. A week from today, the filmmaker and activist Astrid Taylor will be here in conversation with free culture lawyer and activist Elizabeth Stark, and they'll be talking about the future of education. And then at the end of the month, our very last event, we'll have writers Evgeny Morozov and David Auerbach in a debate on technology's false utopias and progressive possibilities, and that will be moderated by Ben Weisner, who's the director of ACLU's Speech, Privacy, and Technology Project. But back to today's event. As many of you know, today's event was initially to include Trevor Paglen in conversation with fearless and intrepid documentary filmmaker and journalist Laura Poitras and the privacy advocate Jacob Applebaum. We wanted to consider the rise of national security and the surveillance state since 9/11 and its assault on freedom of speech, civil liberties, human rights, and privacy. But of course, when we scheduled the event back in April, we couldn't have foreseen all of the disclosures around the NSA in the last month. That the debate around surveillance and privacy and transparency would be at the center of national discussion, and that Laura would be one of the journalists responsible for bringing all of this to light. So, of course, we're sad for her not to be here, but it's understandable, and we're grateful for all the amazing work that she's been doing. So today we are very, very pleased to have with us two exceptional speakers who will be joining Trevor. So Thomas Drake, who is a former senior executive with the National Security Agency, who blew the whistle on massive multi-billion-dollar fraud and violations of the Fourth Amendment and Constitution. The Justice Department subsequently targeted, prosecuted, and indicted Mr. Drake in 2010 for espionage, but the charges were eventually dropped, and he is with us today. He did not escape. Trevor is an artist whose work deliberately blurs lines between science, contemporary art, journalism, and other disciplines. He's the author of 5 books and numerous articles on subjects including experimental geography, state secrecy, military symbology, photography, and visuality. His most recent book, The Last Pictures, is a meditation on the intersections of deep time, politics, and art. And Jesselyn Radak is the Government Accountability Project's National Security and Human Rights Director. In her role, she works primarily with national security and intelligence community whistleblowers, including those from the Defense Department, Department of Homeland Security, the NSA, and the CIA. And she has a special focus on torture, secret surveillance, secrecy, and political discrimination. And she recently represented Tom here on whistleblower matters, stemming from his unsuccessful prosecution under the Espionage Act. So I'd like to welcome them on the stage today.
Okay, so just to outline things a little bit,
we're gonna chat up here for a little bit, and then we'll open it up to questions for all of you. So get your questions ready. Sorry. Okay, so I don't know how many of you saw Trevor's recent piece that he published with Creative Time, but I wanted to ask him to maybe describe some of the, to sort of set the scene and describe some of the arguments he was making there, because I think that often when we talk about issues of surveillance, of privacy, they tend to be isolated from a larger context. And I thought that his piece really did well at sort of describing some of the larger social and political issues that we might think about in such a time.
Super. So just really briefly, I mean, so many of the conversations around surveillance in the last few weeks have been like, oh, well, I don't have anything to hide, so why should I be worried about surveillance? And that's a little bit myopic. And surveillance is bad just in and of itself for reasons that we can go into later if we want to. But when we're talking about NSA surveillance, we're talking about the creation of state institutions that have certain kinds of capacities and things that they want to do. And the creation of this vast domestic surveillance infrastructure is very much a part of a larger project to really reinvent the state, which has been going on since, you know, in the post 9/11 era. This is a project to reinvent the state in terms of redefining what the core capacities of the state are, what the legitimate function of the state are, and how the state itself is going to work. So, I've been thinking about this as the construction of what we might call a kind of terror state, a terror state that is dedicated to this ostensible war on terrorism. It's a state that works in secret, and it's a state that is profoundly anti-democratic. And over the course of the construction of this state, we've seen things slowly happen, seen things that were once considered aberrant or insane become normalized. We've seen things that were previously unquestionably illegal become quote unquote legalized. And we've seen institutions spring up that are dedicated to things that are kind of shocking. We've seen institutions sprung up that are dedicated to indefinite detention. We've seen institutions designed to torture people. We've seen secret prisons. We've seen assassination programs. We've seen the militarization of the internet. We've seen the institutionalization of secret laws. We've seen an assault on leaks and journalism, all of which are unprecedented. And these are state institutions and capacities that are being built on from year to year to year and expanding. Now, what's at stake here is really the kind of soul of what the government is going to be, what the legitimate functions of a government are. And when we put this in a broader kind of context, this is happening against a backdrop of other things going on in the state. And one of the big things going on in society in general that I think is very, very relevant in terms of the future of democracy is the vast bifurcation of society into one of the haves and the have-nots, this kind of extreme exacerbation of income and political inequality that's really been going on since about the 1970s or so, when we've seen wages stagnate or even fall for the working and middle classes, and the collective productivity rises are going almost exclusively to the ruling classes at this point. So we have this trend of rising inequality that doesn't seem to be going anywhere anytime soon, turning us increasingly into a society of haves and have not. At the same time, we are on a collision course with the environment. Things are going to get a lot worse with the environment before they get any better. Things like Katrina's and Sandy's are going to happen more and more often. And this has already happened, even though it's going to take place in the future. That we've already crossed that line. Get ready for it. And so to come back to the construction of this terror state, we're looking forward into a future that is there's going to be a lot of unrest, there is going to be a lot of dissent, there's going to be a lot of turmoil. There's going to be a huge amount of insecurity in the future. And what concerns me is that if you construct institutions like assassination programs and mass surveillance, the government is going to have to respond to the insecurities of the future and what tools will be available to it. We've seen the evisceration of things like public education. We've seen ongoing attacks on Social Security. We've seen the constant and continual cuts and attacks on the parts of the state that are designed to help promote equality, to promote economic and political and medical security. So what kind of state do we want to live in? What I worry about is that as things get more and more insecure, as there's more and more emergencies in the future, that the only buttons the state will be able to push to try to deal with those will be these levers of the terror state. And at that point, that will be the way that the future is dealt with. And that's what concerns me a great deal in terms of the longer term future of these institutions.
Thanks, Trevor. So now maybe we can just start burrowing in a little bit to these levers of the terror state. And so, Jess, I was wondering if maybe you could maybe just outline some of the programs that are being used to justify the widespread surveillance, and if and how they violate federal law, and maybe even address what kind of legal or political agency we might have.
Sure, I think this is on. I look out at most of you, and I hope that most of you remember pre-9/11 America, because I know my own kids, they don't remember the US on September 10th, 2001. They don't. They only know the culture we live in right now. And I feel like, I mean, look, during historical crises, typically, America has always, you know, during national security crisis, they've always clamped down. And we can see horrible things we've done in this country when there's been a national security crisis. For example, the internment of Japanese people, or even earlier, the Alien and Sedition Acts. So I felt like after 9/11, as a lawyer at the Justice Department, as the ethics attorney, I felt like our nation predictably swung here. And I thought with Obama's election, you know, if it matched his rhetoric, we would swing back and reach a point of equipoise where we belonged. But instead, we've swung even further to the right and created, I think we're talking about the same thing when you're talking about a terrorist state and I talk about a surveillance state. I think we're really on the same page here. There have been a number of laws enacted, including the Patriot Act, which was enacted basically in the middle of the night. No one read it. About 11 days or 3 weeks after, I think 3 weeks after 9/11. And it gave sweeping new powers to the executive branch of the government. And then following the Patriot Act, there were a number of other laws that were put into place with lovely little names like the Patriot Act or the Protect America Act, things like that. But they all, ironically, instead clamped down on America in the guise of protecting it from terrorism. So we had a lot of these laws packaged up as in some way making you more secure, when in reality they were taking liberties away. But after 9/11, we were in that climate, and even today, the government continues to fearmonger. So, for example, with Snowden's release of information, this morning I'm on CNN, you know, fighting it out with George Stephanopoulos, who's like, our, you know, people have been hurt, our country is in danger, this has made us vulnerable. I mean, the same old fearmongering that was done right after 9/11 and that worked for a number of years, they're still using it today to justify every illegal, well, embarrassing at best and illegal at worst thing that the government's doing, which is basically a vast expansion of executive power, which completely throws off the checks and balances system upon which our nation was founded. So for example, with Snowden, the party line from the administration is Congress approved it, judges approved it, therefore anything NSA does is legal. Well, my first point to that would be it's not up to the lawbreaker to decide whether or not the crime they committed is legal. And second of all, those premises are completely wrong. Congress may have passed a law, but it certainly was not aware of the secret interpretation of the Patriot Act, Section 215. And the Intel Committee, they were aware of it, but wouldn't even talk about it. They would allude to it. So a lot of Congress people have expressed that they were in the dark about what was going on. And then I think talking about a court approving this is the most disingenuous thing I have heard in a long time, especially as a lawyer. A court, a federal court, which is what most of us are thinking about, which is part of our checks and balances, did not approve this program or any of the prior programs. A secret court called the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, which is a creature of the Justice Department, resides on a mystery floor, which is actually the fifth floor of the Justice Department, and has secret judges, including Judge Lamberth and other people we know of. They approved this program. They only hear the government side of an application for approval. They approve pretty much every application they receive. In 2012, they received close to 2,000 applications for warrants, and they approved every single one. In the entire history, they've rejected one. So this is not a real court. This is a court that was created to deal with foreign intelligence, which begs the second question, which is why the hell would this court be issuing rulings pertaining to domestic, purely domestic intelligence within our country? And I and a number of other lawyers submit that these are not lawful orders. This court was not allowed, it does not have jurisdiction to consider purely domestic communications. So while we have this secret court approving stuff that we won't acknowledge until it becomes revealed by a whistleblower, and then Obama wants to have a robust conversation about it, but starts that off by charging the whistleblower under the Espionage Act, you can kind of get a flavor for where that's going and how genuine people are being about having a real debate about this. As a lawyer and having been a whistleblower myself, really within a couple months after 9/11, you probably won't remember the case, but I had blown the whistle. I was the ethics advisor in the case of the American Taliban, John Walker Lind, who was caught fighting with the Taliban. We were told he was Al-Qaeda, which he was not, and that he killed a CIA officer, which he had not done. But more importantly, I mean, the bottom line is we not only deprived him of counsel, but we tortured him. That was pretty evident by the pictures that were circulating worldwide of him naked, blindfolded, and bound to a board with epithets written all over him, and a bullet in his leg. It was very reminiscent of what we saw 4 years later. These regimes that Tom and I blew the whistle on at different times, well, actually probably around the same time, but they unfolded at different times, were kind of the bookends that we've been dealing with in terms of the two biggest scandals of the Bush administration, namely torture and domestic secret surveillance. Well, I think we've pretty much acknowledged that the domestic secret surveillance is illegal because we passed an entire law to retroactively legalize it and immunize the telephone companies who were participating. Yet that was not enough. The government had to keep continuing it and expanding it further. And torture, I think it's still happening. I think it's diminishing only by the fact that instead we are just assassinating people instead. It takes care of that whole messy torture problem of torturing people and then we can't try them because their cases are so tainted. So instead we just annihilate them and play prosecutor, judge, jury, and executioner of anyone on the planet, including Americans, including children, who are completely innocent. and numerous innocent civilians, countless, far more than the numbers the government gives. But after my ordeal and having blown the whistle and dealt with all this crap from the Bush administration, being put under federal criminal investigation for leaking, which is not a crime, being referred to the state bars in which I'm licensed as an attorney, and being put on the no-fly list. After all of that, I said, I am gonna dedicate my life to representing whistleblowers. So I worked for 2 years for Congressman Grayson when he was in private practice, representing whistleblowers blowing the whistle on Reconstruction fraud in Iraq. And then he got elected to Congress and I went to where I am now. And as bad as my ordeal was, and it was a horrible years-long odyssey, and it was just horrible. I was completely in the wilderness and had very few support mechanisms. It was a very dark time for me. When I read in 2010 that the Justice Department had indicted this guy named Thomas Drake for leaking, and his disclosure sounded like classic whistleblowing to me, I knew we had crossed a line. Because as much as I was put under criminal investigation and harassed unmercifully, at least I never got indicted. And so when I heard that happened, I wrote an op-ed for the LA Times about the difference between whistleblowing and leaking. And the difference is this: when a government employee blows a whistle on what he or she reasonably believes is fraud, waste, abuse, or illegality, that is whistleblowing. You become a whistleblower by operation of law by doing that, whether it's to a congressman or to an inspector general's office or to the media, as much as the government likes to contest that, versus leaking, which is done for no public value whatsoever. For example, the outing of Valerie Plame as a CIA agent merely to punish her husband, Joe Wilson, who I submit was also a whistleblower, for writing a column that the reasons we were going into Iraq were completely bogus. So people blow the whistle because they're worried about the public, as Snowden has expressed, as Tom expressed, worried about the public because we serve, public servants serve the public, not a boss, not an agency, not the president, as Monica Goodling testified during the U.S. attorney scandal. Oh, I made an oath to the president. No, you didn't. You made an oath to uphold the Constitution. And I think that's what drives people to blow the whistle. And really, their motive, if they're out, I mean, they're always accused of being out for fame or profit or revenge or self-aggrandizement. It really, legally, doesn't matter, because the substance of what they blew the whistle on is what matters. We're not shooting the messenger, as much as the White House continues to do that even today, is just a distraction and a way to caricature the whistleblower in a way that completely discredits him, rather than focusing on the message, which is the incredible illegality of what NSA has yet once again done on a scale that completely eclipses what we were dealing with back during the warrantless wiretapping scandal in 2005. So at this point, I'll hand it back to you.
Sorry, I turned it off. How did it lose its way along the way? Thanks.
Where do I start? NSA, never say anything. No such agency. No secrets anymore. In terms of the history, NSA was formed in the deepest of secrecy during the Truman administration. There is a history behind NSA, but NSA itself was formed by a secret presidential directive, which still remains mostly secret to this day. Its primary purpose during the beginning years of the Cold War, 1952 to be exact, was ostensibly to provide foreign intelligence collection to report on it and to keep track primarily of communist countries. And the focus there was the Soviet Union. It developed and evolved over the years. So it's important to note for history that in terms of its public definition, it was always outward facing. And it was always focused on foreign intelligence as distinct from domestic. Domestic was left up to other government agencies. Now, having said that, it turns out there was a number of programs in which NSA was secretly acquiring, collecting, and reporting on domestic communications. Operation Shamrock, look up the history, very interesting program. It goes over many, many years in terms of direct access to telegrams coming into and out of the United States. Operation Minaret, another very interesting program in which NSA was intimately involved in terms of going after dissidents and those that were considered enemies of the state. And yet a number of other programs in which it also cooperated. It all came to a head in terms of history, and I'm really compressing. Other than keeping track of the big red threat, something that I was involved with during the latter years of the Cold War, and I'll just parenthetically insert that the target country, in which I became an expert was East Germany. I'll get back to that. I'm sure we'll circle back, okay? Because I never imagined in the period in which I was listening in on all kinds of communications coming out of East Germany, while sitting in my seat on an airplane several tens of thousands of feet above the earth, I never imagined that that entire regime would be imported lock, stock, and barrel and then greatly expanded in the deepest of secrecy post 9/11. Never imagined that. So we come up to the 60s and 70s, and I'm looking out here. I mean, there's a number of us that I grew up as a very young teenager during the 1970s. My civic awakening took place in the 1970s. So President Nixon, the president says it's so, it must be legal. The House Impeachment Committee, the Pentagon Papers, Daniel Ellsberg, Watergate, the resignation of a president from office. The Church and Pike committee hearings, extraordinary set of hearings, and particularly Senator Frank Church's committee, when it became very evident that behind the scenes in the deep secrecy, NSA, as well as other government agencies, were spying on Americans on a very significant scale and getting away with it. All that came to a head. There was a rebalancing of the checks and balances. Two standing committees on intelligence, permanent committees, were stood up in Congress to oversee the secret side of government. And in 1978, under the Carter administration, you had the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act that was passed, which in itself was a controversial act, because it formed for the first time a secret court that was not part of the Article III definition of a court in the Constitution. So all that's history, right? But history's not kind here. And now you accelerate to 9/11. So for 23 years, there was this legal regime under which NSA operated. And the prime directive is you could not quote-unquote spy on Americans, which by definition was a U.S. person. which included U.S. corporations, resident legal aliens, and U.S. citizens. Could not spy on those three categories. Criminal sanctions under Title 18. Every instance of violation, $10,000 fine, 5 years in prison. Has anybody seen anybody and gone to prison for having violated the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act? Which makes me sitting here in front of you extraordinarily poignant. And so I'm gonna be quite dramatic right now because it's necessary to really ground this conversation in a way that is absolutely necessary, not just for me, not just for you, but for all of us. What does freedom really mean? What does freedom mean to you? What does it mean? I'm listening. What does it mean? Freedom's not free, I'll tell you that right now. It's not. I faced, when I was charged on the Espionage Act, 10 felony counts, five under the Espionage Act, one for obstruction of justice, four for making false statements, with 35 years in prison after they already threatened me with spending the rest of my life in prison if I didn't cooperate with their investigation. I faced the distinct prospect of everything that I stood for and having taken the oath to support and defend the Constitution four times in my government career, everything that this country was about, the highest ideals, the highest of practices, who we are as Americans, and who we are to the world, the distinct prospect of all that being taken away. Why? Because I was reporting and blew the whistle on high crimes and misdemeanors. Everything that Snowden has disclosed to date, none of it is new to me, none of it. The only difference is he got his hands on some very interesting documents. Okay. I chose to blow the whistle within the system over many, many years. But it's important to note right here that all that history was censored, it was suppressed, it was expunged from even the secret reports. Why? Because NSA came in behind me after many, many interviews that I had with 9/11 congressional investigators and said, what he's disclosed is state secrets. State secrets? State secrets in a democracy? State secrets in a constitutional republic? I mean, this is the White House in collusion with NSA, where they unchained themselves from the Constitution right after 9/11, suspended the Fourth Amendment, and violated the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act at will. Acts done deliberately, acts of commission in the deepest of secrecy. That started right after 9/11. What you now have is a systemic Leviathan surveillance state of enormous proportions, and we still have not seen the other shoes that are about to drop in terms of additional disclosures. And it's not just about this country. It's also about the rights of citizens in other countries as well, based on the very latest disclosures that have been coming out over the last several days. There's a whole lot at stake here. A surveillance state, by definition, we're all suspicious. Completely inverts the paradigm. Citizen with rights, whether it's the United States or any other country in this world, are now simply subjects of a state. And what's gold about you is your data. Data is gold. And the more private it is, the more valuable it is.
Can you explain why is that? What is the incentive?
A perverse incentive. See, the Stasi had a motto. It was to know everything. In a surveillance state, there's never enough data. Never enough. It becomes a hoarding complex. You literally want to know everything there is about the subjects under your control, and those that are not under control, you want to bring them under your control. It has nothing to do with terrorism. It has nothing, goes far beyond any other mandates that they speak about. We need to make Americans feel safe again, or we need to safeguard the national security of the United States. Remember, the national security has become a state religion. You don't question it. You don't take issue with it. But what does it do to us as a people? That's the fundamental question that has to be asked. I keep coming back to that because, see, I've lived the surveillance state already. I've lived the future already. This is not something that's in the future. This is not something in 1984. I've already lived it. So let me give you a little bit of a scenario, just for the sake of setting sort of the framing for other things I'm sure we'll discuss. Imagine everything there is to know about your life is provided to the government in secret. Everything. All of it. Every association you've ever had, every neighbor, every contact, every address, every email, all your credit cards, your health records, any transactional information that's available, accessible by the government in secret. Just imagine that for the moment. Okay, now take all of that, just take all of that, and stick it into a lockbox. Go to the other side of town, knock on the door of a perfect stranger, and they happen to be a U.S. citizen, and say, here, I'm giving you my lockbox. This is my life. I want you to have it for safekeeping. Are you going to do it? This is your life, right? Fellow citizen is going to take care of it. Are you going to give them your life for safekeeping? Are you? Are you?
Which I think comes to the trust of the government argument.
I'm asking. This is crucial because my entire life was turned completely inside out and upside down. Everything the government could find out about me and then some was made available to them over many, many years. And on top of that, they kept generating new data and information about my life by physically surveilling me and electronically surveilling me. Every time I give this privacy exercise, guess what? Everybody says, of course not. But here's the crucial question. Why not? You don't trust your fellow citizen? If you say you don't trust your fellow citizen, and that's by consent, by the way, that's your choice, then why would you trust the government in secret to, quote unquote, take care of your secrets? Really? History's not kind. A surveillance state will abuse, misuse what it finds out about you. And this red herring, this false argument, which is really a false flag argument, if you have nothing to hide, which I was told after 9/11 when I confronted a number of very high senior officials, well, if you don't have anything to hide, you have nothing to worry about. You don't get a choice as to what is done with that data. You don't get a choice as to what is done with that information. They get to decide what they do with that information. It's fundamental to who we are as human beings, not just in the United States, but in the world. Freedom means everything. If you have that amount of power invested in a secret surveillance state with tentacles deeply buried, not just in society, but around the world, what does that do to the rights of citizens? So, I'm sure we're going to have more conversation about this.
Thanks, Tom. Jessalyn, I had a question for you because I came across this quote from Julian Assange from a 2006 article that he wrote called State and Terrorist Conspiracies. And in it, he's kind of describing why he thinks that WikiLeaks or leaking is a way to kind of cut at the heart of the authoritarian regime. So he, and the I guess like the first tenet you have to understand is that for him, conspiracy is at the heart of authoritarianism. So you destroy the conspiracy by making it so paranoid of itself that it can no longer conspire. The more secretive or unjust an organization is, the more leaks induce fear and paranoia in its leadership and planning coterie. This must result in minimization of efficient internal communications mechanisms and consequent system-wide cognitive decline, resulting in decreased ability to hold on to power as the environment demands adaptation. Hence, in a world where leaking is easy, secretive, or unjust, systems are non-linearly hit relative to open, just systems, since unjust systems, by their nature, induce opponents, and in many places barely have the upper hand. Mass leaking leaves them exquisitely vulnerable to those who seek to replace them with more open forms of governments. So I guess I just have a question here about this relationship between transparency and surveillance. So because you had just distinguished the leak from whistleblowing, but I just wonder whether you would agree with sort of Assange's assessment. Like, is leaking potentially this knife at the heart of the authoritarian regime?
His definition of leak is different than the one I was talking about in terms of the bad leaks. And part of that problem is leak. Everyone uses that term. So for whistleblower, I always talk about whistleblower disclosures because of the negative connotations a lot of people, at least in the U.S., attach to leaks. But wiki disclosures doesn't sound nearly as good as WikiLeaks. And I think Julian's point is that the more a system, I mean, the more you see the United States cracking down on information, and who cares about your private information or why? It's because information is a currency of power. And the U.S. has been relying on this argument that, like, we collect and store it, but, no harm, no foul. Like, no one's doing anything with it. And they're using this twisted definition of collect, that it's not really collected unless someone actually reads it, which is not our normal understanding of that. And then today, in the latest revelations in the last 24 hours, we find out that in real time, people are monitoring current as well as previously collected communications. So if you become targeted for whatever reason, whether it's because you're in the Tea Party or because you're an activist on an issue and the government doesn't like your cause, or you are, a thorn in their side, for whatever reason, they can decide to drill down on you. And I can't think of a single person in the room who can say, I have lived such a pure, clean, vanilla life that I have no secrets, nothing embarrassing. I've never done anything bad to anyone. I don't have anything I'm ashamed of or that I would want to hide. And I think what he's referring to here is kind of what Tom alluded to. The normal paradigm for a democracy is that the work of the government is public and people's personal lives are private. And we've completely inverted that to where the work of the government is done in secrecy and your private lives are open fodder for the government. So in that context, I understand what he's saying. I think the more the government clamps down on you and your information and backdoors Google and Apple and Facebook and all these things where we're voluntarily placing information, it does create this sort of unintended consequence, or not intended by the government at least, of people saying, this is fucked up, and leaking or disclosing or making this known. If I didn't believe that in the heart of all of us was a tendency to want to do the right thing, then I wouldn't be out here speaking to you. I mean, I don't feel like I know we're probably jumping ahead in your thing, but I don't feel like we're beyond the point of no return. If I did feel that way, I wouldn't keep doing what I'm doing. But I think what he's referring to is sort of the more you try to bottle up this information, the more society needs a safety valve. And then that comes out in leaks, and then the government overreacts and charges people with espionage and treason to shut them down and to make an example of them and to plug the leak. And then the more other people start leaking. And we end up in this push and pull, which I would want to try to avoid, because, I mean, this country was founded upon a revolution against precisely this kind of clampdown by an imperial-minded leader. So that's my take on what he said.
Thanks. And Trevor, I guess because this conversation is ostensibly leading to the future at some point, at least, maybe I can ask you, what can we do as individuals? I mean, I know in an email exchange that we had, you mentioned that you're not really convinced by someone like Assange or even Applebaum's prescriptive to, you know, you fight surveillance with crypto. I mean, it's if you don't know, it's very complicated to use. It's not accessible to everyone. And at the same time, it also kind of locates this idea of freedom within the internet itself, rather than sort of in our broader like social
it's
and political sphere.
It's also a reactionary place to begin the conversation right. From the first place. I mean, you know, the need for crypto assumes the surveillance data right. In the first place. I want to go back. We can start with the Assange question and then move into this. I strongly disagree with that that analysis that leaks. Sure, they challenge the system and they force the system to come up with things, and they're a good thing. But at the same time, over and over again, what we've seen this history of this construction of this war on terror state it's happened over and over again. Whether it's the rendition or the NSA programs, where they're doing something in secret, it's illegal, it gets leaked out, and then it gets retroactively legalized, or you know whatever it is, it becomes a part of a legitimate function of the state precisely because it's not secret anymore, right? When it was still secret, the reason for doing something in secret is because it's probably illegal, right? I mean, but when it becomes disclosed, so I just think it's a lot more complicated than you know the fact that something becomes public information does not necessarily mean that it's going that it is somehow ameliorated or it gets automatically shut down. I mean, again, coming back to the idea, these are institutions. They're not, you know, little amoebas that when they're exposed to the sun, they go away, right? They're, in fact, quite the opposite. They evolve so that they can live in the sun. Going back to that, so in terms of imagining a different kind of future, you know, guys like Julian and Jake, I would push back against the idea of crypto. They say, you know, there should be widespread, you know, availability of people to have cryptologic tools. Yes, if you are, you know, involved in an activist organization doing that kind of work, you should absolutely understand how to use those tools and be using them. However, that is not going to save us, right, collectively. I think the only way out of this is actually to start shutting these institutions down, right? I mean, it won't exist. You know, whatever the future is going to be is made out of the stuff that exists today and the stuff that is being built today. So the only way to change the future is to dismantle the stuff that's going to make the future. Make the stuff that you want the future to look like, get rid of the stuff that you don't want to be a part of the future. And when I say stuff, I mean that literally, like shutting down buildings, firing people, reducing budgets, building up more civil parts of the state, right? Just reimagining what the government is. The government is first and foremost a set of civic institutions, is what people get together and do that none of us can do individually to provide for each other. And I think that definition of what the point of a democratic state is has really been lost and feels very remote. And for me, that's the only possible way forward without going in a very, very troubling direction.
And Tom, Trevor is talking about the dismantling of our government institutions. How likely is that for something like the NSA?
I'll channel Frederick Douglass. Power will not yield willingly. These are institutions that have truly extraordinary power. They enjoy that power. They enjoy having the control over others. They're parasites that feed off privacy and information about people. They're not going to let it go willingly. I'll be the first to tell you that what's happened, and it's fundamental to the future, is that if you want a different future, then part of what has to happen is things like Restore the Fourth, a rally here in New York City, Union Square, or I'll be speaking at the Restore the Fourth rally. It's actually sponsored by BORDC in DC. That's one of the kind of local organic mechanisms that are available to us, if it matters. And I say if it matters, because simply highlighting the Leviathan state or the surveillance state or a government out of control or a government that's unchained itself from the Constitution and punishing those who would dare speak truth to or of power, that's necessary for maximum exposure and disclosure as to what they're up to on our behalf, but it will not create the new future. I would say the best way to predict the future is to create it now, but you have to create it now from the future. And I stand in that space because obviously having lived the future already, I don't want that future lived by anybody else going forward. And because I was able to keep my freedoms, that's the voice, the space of the voice, and where I, from where I stand. I'm actually speaking to you from that future right now. If that means dismantling the government where it's possible, then so be it. For example, NSA, I'd be the first to tell you, I'd be an advocate to dismantle NSA, but they're not going to willingly give up that power. They have far too many mechanisms right now within the government to do so. Now, having said that, look at East Germany. For all that they put into place, and to include putting up an actual wall around most of the country to keep people in, that country doesn't exist anymore. But what we have in this country, as well as increasingly in other countries, is a digital fence, a digital wall. And though it may look transparent, the fact remains that because so much of our society is in the digital and internet space, much of that is obviously, with all these disclosures increasingly being monitored. So the fundamental question is, does it matter enough to you, we as a citizenry? Do we really want that kind of government serving in their interests, not ours? That's the fundamental question. And are the mechanisms available to you, to us, in which to resist? Of course there are. I mean, it's an irony of history that the first American Revolution, I can argue as a student of history and politics, was fundamentally centered on all the violations of activities that are actually given to us as rights, inalienable rights, in the First and Fourth Amendment, as well as the Fifth, Sixth, Seventh, and Eighth, and others. In fact, remember, it had to tack on a Bill of Rights because there was so much concern about a centralized government taking over the other two branches. They had already passed, we have to go out with 10 amendments to a constitution they had just ratified. And that took another couple of years. See, I come from Texas and Vermont. Texas was a republic before it became a state. I grew up most of my youth and until young adulthood in Vermont, the first republic, 14 years as an independent republic, very reluctantly joined the United States in 1791. Does it matter to us? I mean, I have people in my social network that say, Tom, they've already become so jaded and so cynical that they will not take up any cause. Is that what you want to do? Because that's self-fulfilling. You're just going to watch society crumble before you? Is that the kind of future you want to live? Remember, this is not about us individually. It was never about me individually blowing the whistle within the system. And then I ultimately did make a fateful choice to go to a reporter in 2006 with what I knew about the secret surveillance programs, plural, as well as massive fraud, waste, and abuse being committed by the government. It was never about me personally. It was about our future. But the Constitution is just an idea. Freedom's just an idea. Rights are just an idea. Natural law, quote unquote, what, it's just ideas. Those things have to live within us. If we want to let, you know, with or without our consent, remember the governance, remember we're human beings in terms of history. We don't do very well controlling others. We don't do very well ruling over others. There will those who will take manifest destiny. There will those who say they're better. There will be the elites. All that psychology about why I should run and control your life. But the promise of the Constitution, the promise of the Declaration of Independence, the promise of the Bill of Rights was to be lived out. Those weren't empty. You want to give all that up for what? And my voice alone, our voices alone here, are insufficient. But they create the space for the conversation in which to have that discussion about what future do we want to keep. That's what's fundamental here. Because if we don't talk about that in light of all the disclosure should be a call to action, a cause for action. It's not just, oh, look at that, the government's screwing up again. Yeah, we already knew that. We'll just find out more details. Then it becomes more you're just a spectator. You got to get on the field of play. Can't just be a spectator. Democracy and freedom is not a spectator sport. This is not reality TV. This is your life, our life, our future.
Jess, I was wondering if you had anything to say on the matter, thinking about what kinds of legal, what kind of laws we can implement, or if there are regulations. I mean, it just, if the rule of law isn't abided by those who create the laws in the first place, then what can we do within the legal framework?
Yeah, unfortunately, the legal framework right now doesn't seem to be a very fruitful avenue. Even though I'm a lawyer, I'm still going to try that. But basically, when we try to bring challenges against this very aberrational, unconstitutional, illegal behavior, the executive comes in and shuts down those lawsuits by asserting state secrets privilege or standing issues. Congress, for the few people who do have some kind of backbone and want to do anything, they get limited by everyone else. I mean, there's Wyden, there's Udall, there's Merkley, there's some really good people in there, some really good people, but they, again, get shut down by the others. My advice to everyone is play to your strength. I'm a lawyer. I think I'm a pretty good lawyer. I'm going to keep pushing those avenues. All these slides that are getting released, I'm going to enter them into the congressional record, because whether it's now or 10 years from now or 20 years from now, they need to be part of the historical record of this country, because I really do feel like it's going to take a decade or so to undo this. I hope that my children will read about these cases in law school or in history in college and just cringe at what's going on here. But if you're an artist like Trevor, if you're an activist, if you're a singer or a writer, whatever your strength is, there are ways to contribute to this fight. I mean, the easiest thing is go on change.org, and there are a bunch of, type in civil liberties, and there are a bunch of petitions you can just sign, and they will automatically send it to your member of Congress and to the president. If not, that's not your thing, show up at the Bradley Manning trial if you have some free time during the summer. It's going on for another 8 weeks or so, and often I would be one of five people in the courtroom as a spectator and the only human rights attorney there. We need people to do that. There are a million little ways you can help fight this by, again, Laura's a documentarian, Laura Portress, and she's really changing things. I mean, she did an op-ed documentary on my client, Bill Binney, who is a co-whistleblower with Tom. And Snowden said that that was part of what inspired him to make his disclosures. So even if you don't feel how what you do is interconnected right now, you will. I live in Washington, D.C., and it was discovered that there was a camera in the bathroom of a Starbucks. And was it someone's idea of a practical joke? No, Starbucks said, we put it in the bathroom to avoid fights. I'm not sure who you would be like having a fight with in the bathroom, but I thought it would spark at least some populist outrage that in Starbucks they would have a camera pointed right at the toilet. And nothing, not a single letter to the editor, no late night comedian joking about it, no reaction whatsoever. And I feel like the more this becomes normalized, the more people don't question it. So when you think about something, when they say, oh yeah, we take a picture of your license plate every single time you drive into Washington, D.C., say why? When the government says, don't worry, we're not collecting any information that's not in your phone bill, ask, why the heck is it okay for the government to know what's in my phone bill? You could have a call to a suicide prevention hotline. You could have a call to a divorce attorney. You could have a call to all your oncologist. You could have all sorts of things that the government has no business knowing in your phone bill alone. So when the government says, don't worry, we're not collecting content, they're using their twisted definition of content. Or don't worry, we're only collecting the metadata. Who's calling who, how often, and for how long. I can tell you, you can get a hell of a lot more information about an individual from their metadata than from their content. A lot of their content is actually useless. It may be somewhat salacious or fun to look at, but pretty useless. And whether it's, you know, some TSA agent who's interested in digging down on Britney Spears' passport, or a government official interested in digging down on you because they decide they don't like what you're doing, this is a very, very dangerous place that we're in. So please use whatever your particular talent is to try to fight back against this.
Thanks. Trevor, did you have a response to that at all? Or actually, I was just thinking back to your email again. You mentioned, should we rethink the internet? And I was just wondering what exactly you meant by that, or if you thought that was even possible, because it seems like sort of reactionary, like Luddite positions are not sort of very realistic. But
that's not actually my position. That's okay. Like Julian Assange and right. Jake's in their book. They say, you know, these are guys who are way in the internet, and they have, you know, it's a polemic, but say like, you know, the internet is the most powerful threat to democracy that exists right now. This is, you know, these guys, you know, live online saying this. And that it was a question that when I thought Jake was going to be here, that I wanted to push on him a little bit about, you know, but I'm sure you have something to say about that too.
Actually, the internet is the greatest threat to the surveillance state and tyranny. But here's the paradox. Internet was a government creation. You go back to DARPA, Defense Advanced Research Project Agency. If you had a nuclear winter, how could you get a message out? That was the fundamental premise that created internet before internet became popular. So it's really paradoxical that now the government wants to take it back. They want to own it because it's too much of a threat. But it's also a place, is the extraordinary richness and variety and all the sharing that takes place and all the communication. I can't begin, I'm not giving up internet. And so I will tell you, in defense of Julian and Jake and Laura and any of the others, encrypt the crap out of your life, okay? It's only prudent. Why make it easy for the government? Make it as hard as possible, recognizing that there's still their ways are gonna gain access to it. But what the heck? Now, I've had some people say it doesn't matter, and it is true. Based on disclosures, based on what I knew before these disclosures made by Snowden, one of the things that the government has been very cool about, cool from their perspective, is we get direct access to the internet service providers, what's called the upstream data, because that's before it goes out, pre-encryption. Think about it. I mean, that's what makes those alliances with those very large corporations, those very large providers, so pernicious. But yet, why are they doing that? Remember, not only are you paying for those services, they're selling you, your fragmented being, your fragmented life, you're being reduced to just a bunch of data dots somewhere, little packets somewhere that are stored about you, and selling it back to the government. Remember, they're not doing this for free, believe me. They're not. So they're making money both ways. What a racket that is, right? So privatizing, and I'm going to say that privatizing, but privatizing not in the corporate sense. A corporation is a very strange entity in modern society anyways when it was first created. I'm talking about privatizing at the level of individuality. That's where it lives. That's where it must exist. And so it's only prudent to conduct your life in a way where it is sensitive to be as safeguarding that as much as you possibly can.
So I think we've been talking for about an hour, so maybe I'll just open it up to questions. But I would ask that if you have a question, you come down to the front of the room and you speak into the microphone there. And And you can start making your way down. Sam.
Hi. Okay. Anyway, just wanted to kind of follow up on a little bit of what was said. The camera in the Starbucks bathroom and some of this stuff around the internet more generally. I mean, I think like even if we got a very strong political movement together and, you know, scaled back the NSA and delinked the NSA from Google's data and Facebook's data and so on and so forth, it still seems that, I mean, not to be a technological determinist, but Google and Facebook and so on and so forth are becoming these quasi-state actors, and we're going to be getting a lot of really good things in the future from all the data they collect, and also they're going to become increasingly, you know, and you can maybe not have a Facebook account, but you're still going to be using Google. You know, when Google's a self-driving car, it's going to have a camera that's taking a million photos a minute, and that's all going to be in Google. And I, you know, those don't seem to have a political solution when these companies that are giving us a lot of really great things are also acquiring an enormous amount of data on us. I mean, they don't have police or a military, but I don't see a way out of that except becoming a Luddite, which doesn't seem like a societal solution. It seems like a potentially and nearly impossible individual one, if that.
Look, I'm just, it's a consent thing with a company. It's not a consent thing with a government. That's why it breaks the contract. You didn't sign a contract when you signed up for Facebook or a Google account or Yahoo or Paltalk. You didn't sign and opt in that they would give that data to the government, did you?
Part of the problem here is a law, and it can be fixed by the law. There's a loophole in the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act that has been expanded beyond the wildest imagination. I think that's why you had some companies saying, we legitimately did not know that they were parking themselves completely on our server, because the NSA itself got up and testified before Congress. We have the power to do that, and we don't have to tell them. So that loophole needs to be closed. I know that's very weedy and lawyerly, but there are petitions on change.org to do that, because there's a sunset provision on all these pernicious laws every 3 years or so, and we need to let the sun set rather than renewing them over and over and over again. And so I know there's been confusion about how complicit. I mean, Tom's right. These companies are getting paid, some of them are at least, money by the government to turn over user data. But I think there's a lot of user data that's being collected by the government that these companies don't know about. And then companies that do challenge it, the number one that I would give props to would be Twitter. You know, end up getting shut down and gag orders slapped on them so they can't talk about it. So I don't want to defend these corporations at all, but I do think the concern that, what do? We can't just stop using Google or, you know,
you
the
could
nine
regulate
biggest telecom.
Google. You could regulate Facebook. I mean, that's
you're
an
the
easy
user.
One.
Yeah, exactly.
Say, pass the law, says Facebook, whatever. You can do this with the data. You can't do that with the data. I mean,
But that's the problem with the law, though, because you can adjust your privacy settings so the whole world can't see your Facebook, or you can opt out of it altogether and be like, you know what, I'm sick of Facebook, I'm tired, I'm going to close my account. But the government, still without the company's knowledge, through this loophole in FISA that's very arcane and that's hard to explain, can park itself on these telecoms without even telling them. And that's what's creating a lot of the confusion right now, legally.
Wilson.
Hi. I think you've all made a really good case for why we should find it very problematic that the government is spying on its citizens. But part of what concerns me about the kind of discourse that seems so prevalent in these conversations is this real kind of nationalist bent to it. And I'm wondering, while we're in a venue like this and we're discussing what kind of future we would like to envision, and you're making a strong case for mobilizing for government regulation, what should be our position, or what are your positions on this kind of behavior abroad, or, you know, in such a globalized world? Like, do we say it's absolutely unacceptable for the U.S. government to be spying on and assassinating U.S. citizens, but it's all right for them to be doing it abroad. I mean, I think that this is a real moment to reconsider and to think about sort of where we draw the line, and is it really citizen-based? Which it sounds like in a lot of these discussions, that's what the concern is, and is that, you know, where we should be focusing our efforts?
The surveillance state is global. It's not restricted to the U.S. This idea of there's citizens of the U.S., domestic and somehow are foreigners. I've said this in other four, we're all foreigners now. This, everybody's treated equally in that regard in terms of surveillance. It doesn't matter. So the real question here is, in terms of the global commons, do you want this kind of arrangement being made? I'm actually for far less government, interestingly enough, and far less regulation than I am for not, because regulation in itself has been used as a backdoor means. It's a corruption mechanism, and so the government continued to exert other kinds of control in secret off the books. I mean, ostensibly, this is what all this legal framework was supposed to be providing, was all these protections and safeguards. Now we're recognizing it's a total kabuki dance. It was always a false front, blazing saddles. It looked nice in terms of the edifice, but as soon as you open the door, guess what? They could do whatever they wanted to behind the fronts. This is not just a U.S. problem. We've been overseas, Jesselyn and myself, and in partnership with others, extraordinary conversations about what's the threat to the global commons. I'm actually for far less government, not more government. Some people have even accused me of expressing anarchist perspectives in this regard. Well, so be it, okay? Why would we as citizens give up so much of what's fundamental to us, our inalienable rights, to a corporation, to a government, to some distant body, when it's not serving in our interests? That's fundamentally what's at stake. And the problem is you have groups of individuals. I mean, I will tell you, I've been at the very tippy top in the halls of power. Weird things happen to people when they've got control over information about others and access to information about others. They begin to feed off of it. It becomes a pathological condition to know something you don't know, or to know something about you and you don't know that they know it. That's not the social contract or the social compact between people. Why would we accede to that? That's where I fundamentally draw the line, period. And again, I have to say it, I'm exhibit number one. The government wanted to drive the stake of national security right through me, stick it out in the comments and say, this is what happens when you hold up that mirror. And part of it is for censorship, part of it is to chill, part of it is to say, we want to engender fear so you won't say anything. There's a very interesting statement that was made by the head of the DNI, Clapper, James Clapper, a couple of years ago when all the WikiLeaks revelations started coming out in significant amount. He said, every intelligence community, oxymoron, community employee should be like my grandchildren, seen and not heard. It probably says far more about his relationship with his grandchildren than it does about how he looks at intelligence community employees. That's a psychological condition. That's what we have to focus on. The psychology behind this. They love this is in secret, taking away the essence of who you are because they get to do so without your knowledge. We're not consenting to that. That's where the line must be drawn.
I just wanted to ask you, Jess, if you had any quick thoughts about that, because legally our Constitution does not extend protection to non-citizens, or does it?
It does. Okay. In a number of cases, it actually does. And that's been a huge issue about why Guantanamo is so problematic and why calling people unlawful belligerents is problematic and why Tom and myself are part of the lawsuit against the NDAA provision that allows for indefinite preventive detention of Americans. We're already doing it, obviously, to the people on Guantanamo Bay who are non-Americans, but they're still, I mean, we're having a huge clash over that. The Constitution does extend certain rights, not just to an American or a U.S. citizen. The other thing I just wanted to mention is often, I know at least with Tom and myself, and I imagine with Trevor, you get accusations that you think everything should be out there, you don't think anything should be secret. And that's really a red herring. Look, I realize that there are secrets that our nation should keep in terms of sources and methods, or troop movements, or nuclear design information. There are some things that are legitimately secret, but the flip side of the war on whistleblowers and the war on journalists is massive overclassification that ballooned under Bush to this gargantuan size, and in Obama's first term, exceeded that by 77%. So, I mean, we really, there are people who stamp baby announcements classified. There are New York Times articles by Mark Manzetti that have been stamped classified. Classifying stuff retroactively was the underpinning of what brought the downfall of Tom's case, because they took stuff out of his house and then did a classification review, decided it was classified, and then prosecuted him with that. Obviously, if you're driving 45 miles an hour in the 45 mile an hour zone today, and then they put up a sign tomorrow and say it's 20 miles an hour and then go after you because you were doing the speed limit properly today, that's not okay. That's why our Constitution prohibits ex post facto laws. But the overclassification is another huge symptom of the secrecy regime that we had not addressed today that I wanted to bring up.
So secret law, secret rules, secret governance is absolutely anathema to democracy. And what you're seeing in the surveillance state is it's eating out the heart of who we are as a people, not just in this country, but in other countries. That again, I keep coming back to, is what's at stake.
Okay, thank you. Next question.
Hi, so this is a two-part question. The first part is, I really want to encourage everyone to check out restorethefourth.net. And like Tom said, a lot of people say, oh, well, I oppose this, but what do I do about it? Well, we're doing something about it, and the way you can participate is coming out on July 4th. The second part of the question is, so is your sense that most of the classified programs have been revealed now by Snowden, or are there still significant revelations that you think are going to come out in the near future?
Based on what I was exposed to when I was still at NSA between 2001 and 2008, there's a lot more to come out. A lot more. It was said just a few short days ago, we've only seen the tip of the iceberg. I don't think people really appreciate that the heart of 1984 is already here. It really is. I don't think people fully appreciate how intrusive the surveillance state has become within our society. I don't think people fully appreciate it yet. Because see, one of the interesting dynamics, does it affect you when you're walking down the street? Does it directly affect you? And that's one of the things that they're operating on, is that, well, hey, you know, if you're not in our target list, or you're in our realm of threats, whatever that form takes, then hey, we're just gonna continue to sweep it up, because here's the catch 22, Joseph Heller novel. We have the power now, who's gonna stop us? In Jane Mayer's article about me called The Secret Share, which was published in May of 2011. There's a rather dramatic confrontation that Diane Rourke, who used to have the NSA account when she was a professional staffer on the HPSI, the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence, in the summer of 2002, she confronted General Hayden. And it came down to the following: why did you do it? Meaning, just revoke the Fourth Amendment and FISA. Because we had the power. Because we had the power? That's why.
So there's a lot of questions and probably not that much time. So maybe we can try to move
to a follow-up with you, Tom? Like, when I imagine further disclosures, it would be interesting to whether their ones... So I would imagine there could be disclosures about, okay, it's not just Verizon, it's bank records, it's medical records, it's... you know, any kind of electronic record in the world. And I could see like a series of disclosures. No, here's the memo about, right, you know, whatever, you know, HMO, you know, here's a memo about banks and so on and so forth. On one hand, I could also see other things, information about how the ways these different pieces of information are collated and synthesized. In other words, like, what are the programs that synthesize information and how do they do that? Is that the kind of thing that you would imagine, or is there something more to it, or is that basically how the whole thing works?
The There's a lot more programs that exist that have not been publicly disclosed. What can I say? I disclosed everything I knew to two 9/11 congressional investigations and yet others in the government, okay? What you're seeing now is 10 years later, the metastasization, the cancer on the body politic, now being fully normalized, fully institutionalized. They're not gonna give it up. And so part of the disclosures is to show the extent to which this has actually grown from within and overseas. Remember, all these special arrangements that NSA has with other intelligence entities and other intelligence agencies overseas. Some cases, the government themselves are in secret agreement and they're not telling their own citizens. Never mind other programs, which like Jesselyn made reference to, where they're actually, the NSA itself is gaining quote unquote access to other databases without even the knowledge of those companies. Never mind the arrangements they make. We're talking about yet other programs. I mean, this again, they can't get enough data, right? So these are the kinds of things. Or what's already coming out, the disclosures, which is causing quite a stir right now in Europe, where direct spying operations inside the European Union and other offices, governance offices within the EU, and also direct access to citizen data, European citizen data. For what purpose? I mean, this presumption that you have any rights at all, it completely disappears in a secret surveillance state. That's really what's at issue here.
Thanks. Maybe we can do something where we take like three questions at a time, or two questions at a time. Is that just because there's a lot of people. I'll try to keep it fast.
You talk about the future and trying to shut down the institutions that you don't want to see as part of the future, so shrinking budgets. I'm just worried about the private sector and the profit margin, and how do you stop the people from the NSA just going to HB Gary or Blackwater and getting paid there to do it? How do you take away that profit incentive for that? And then the other thing I wanted to ask was, I feel like we gave up all this metadata and they've been watching us and we're not getting anything back for it. If they couldn't stop Boston, what are they stopping? And could you ever stop something like that where it's just two people? I mean, does looking at more and more information have any effect? Thanks.
Yeah.
My question is related to at least one of his. Thomas Drake said that data is gold, and I'm thinking about the literalness of that. Since the increase in the growth of the surveillance state seems to have coincided with growth of the corporation system and the inequities, the further inequities between income groups, I wonder if knowing this, if it is the case, there is a connection, will this help us fight?
So do you guys want to one more, and then we'll go through them. Yeah.
I was just thinking, I guess like the looming thing on the horizon. I always wonder, like, we're gonna have a whole nother conversation when Google Glass becomes more widespread. And I just think about the implications of that. And you know, also the conflict between, okay, we want our privacy, but also at the same time, I think there's a totally undeniable, just like, what can I say, proclivity that, you know, people like attention. Facebook and all this stuff is not popular for no reason. And the conflict between getting people to care about their privacy versus something that, you know, obviously caught on, hit something in the human condition for a reason, and also the conflict of that being marketed to you, you know, very aggressively in terms of this product you can share with this and da-da-da-da-da-da. I don't know, just all that stuff.
That reminds me, ever seen the movie Minority Report? What you're essentially creating here in a surveillance society, not just the United States, but across the world, is a pre-crime database, pre-crime. So in essence, you map everything, all social connections, all interactions. And at any time, if there's an anomaly based on algorithms, right, big data algorithms, it'll flag or highlight. But any activity that you conduct or add to it gets also made part of the larger. So I say that because this is really, it's flipping, again, it's flipping all this on its head. It just can't, I mean, something has to give. It's as simple as that. if the government was really that benevolent, if the government was really doing this in our best interest, why would they do all this in secret? You can't, in a democracy, you must have open debate about the very things that affect the heart of the democratic experience. You must. If you're not doing it, that means they're serving other interests, the very interests that were highlighted in these other questions in terms of these secret alliances, or in some cases without the alliance with these corporations. That's a different form of government. That's a different form of governance. It's certainly not democracy.
But I think the first question may have been getting at the fact that, look, we have outsourced so much stuff, and in the early 2000s, NSA made a corporate decision to buy, not make. Instead of making and creating stuff internally, they were going to outsource it to huge defense contractors. Defense contractors, they have gotten so, made a lot of millionaires after 9/11. And these people, by the way, were involved in and out of these agencies. The head of NSA was the head of SAIC, then came back to NSA, and then went back to SAIC, which, by the way, gets all the no-bid contracts worth billions, millions and billions of dollars to build crap that doesn't even work. So the outsourcing problem, I mean, there are a lot of these contractors who are feeding off the surveillance state and the post-9/11 fear, and that needs to be curbed dramatically.
Look, it's a huge racket, okay? Let's be straight here. It's a total racket. And they're feeding off of us. The largest redistribution of wealth in this country alone was triggered by 9/11. We're talking trillions and trillions of dollars going from the public coffers into the private banking accounts and private corporate accounts. It's massive. You just add up the dollars in terms of what we spend on Homeland Security, national security, Department of Defense, military, that entire complex, right? For what? For what? What are we getting in return? That's the fundamental question we have to ask.
Well, the 1/6 of the entire federal budget is allocated to national defense, and that buys a lot of useless security theater, like stupid airport machines you have to walk through that are full body scanners, like soft porn body scanners, and taking off your shoes because the shoe bomber did it, and thank God we don't have to go commando because of the underwear bomber, but it's stupid security. I mean, this is not intelligent. A lot of the stuff we're doing is theatrics, as evidenced by the Boston bombing. For all the cameras in the world, it didn't prevent or detect what happened. In fact, the government had to crowdsource its search for the perpetrators of the Boston bombing based on other people's pictures and photos and that kind of thing. So it tells you, putting up cameras all over the world, on every single store, on every single block in DC at least, I can tell you, you cannot go anywhere without being filmed. That has not worked. It's one of those lazy security theatrical things that we do where people think or feel safer when it does absolutely nothing other than provide the government another mechanism to intrude on your privacy.
Let's go with the next three questions.
Yeah.
And the last question, sorry.
So we've been talking sort of a lot about how I think Tom used sort of the metaphor of like it's metastasized, it's a cancer on the body politic. But it seems like if we look sort of at the history of surveillance in this country, it's not that it's really like a unique thing now, just that it's gotten bigger. I mean, clearly we were spying on people who were communist or even vaguely left. I mean, Fred Hampton had some experience with that, and you get to now, you know, if you're a Muslim student in college, somebody's probably watching you. So I guess I wonder, to return this sort of to the language of digital things, how much of this is actually a bug and how much of this is just sort of a feature of the system we have?
Actually, it's both. Having worked in the space of detecting bugs, bugs can become features. Zero-day exploits are being sold by Microsoft to the government before they patch them. So it's both a bug and a feature. Is a feature enables surveillance state? It's a bug because it actually is a zero-day problem. That's partly the kind of the paradox here within the digital space. I guess part of this is how much I mean, I keep coming back to it, and I'm kind of listening to you all in the audience here. It's your future, okay? It really is. Some of us have taken extraordinary stands with extraordinary sacrifices, willing to serve many, many decades in prison, right? For the sake of freedom and liberty. If that matters, you're gonna defend it. If that matters in your life, you will take the actions necessary to defend it. You will, because that's what matters to you. Or if you just wanna, and I'm gonna say this again, and some people have objected when I say this, if reality TV and bread and circuses and entertainment are sufficient enough for you going forward, that's what will take care of your needs, the lower levels of the Abraham Maslow's hierarchy of needs, so be it. So don't be surprised at what you get. You'll get the government you deserve to keep. That's not the government I want to keep. That's not the future I want to keep. I'm going to become the ultimate resistor to any form. You maybe saw the Q on my jacket before I took it off. Q stands for this: question everything, especially authority. Especially authority.
But I was going to say, your point is true, absolutely true. I think our country power structures have gone after people who threaten them, whether it's the Black Panthers, whether it's domestic communists, whether now it's terrorists who are really Arab and Muslim people who happen to be living their lives, and we create terrorist plots for them. This has been a historical factor. I think it's been aided and abetted by an order of magnitude because of the internet. The government can do a lot more in terms of rounding up large swaths of people and turning them into suspects when they're really completely innocent, and watering down the probable cause that you normally needed to search someone, making it probable suspicion, reasonable suspicion, maybe an inkling to almost nothing.
When the First and Fourth Amendment become a threat to the national security state and due process in terms of law, guess what? In the rights of the accused, you're now inverting the equation, the fundamental equation of democratic governance.
Okay, I wanted to thank you all, three of you, for your work and your extreme courage, first of all. And my question is sort of in two parts. The first part is following this idea that the Stasi motto is to know everything. What is the status of paranoia when public goes private and private goes public? I mean, clinically, psychoanalysis defines paranoia as the attempt to know everything. And are you guys sort of advocating that as a political action or something different? And then the second part of the question is a little bit more specific, for example, the reporter Hastings, the Rolling Stone reporter who outed McChrystal, who recently died, and we're not really hearing a lot about, I mean, it's easy to become paranoid. Like, and to what extent do you think that works as a political strategy, or, you know, it actually can be self-sabotaging?
I think paranoia is totally disabling. And when you look at things like mass surveillance, you look at the NSA, you look at the CIA, these are things that we have been taught to be afraid of for very, very good reasons. But at the same time, politically, we can't live in a society where we are afraid of our own government. Then we lose, right? That's the old, you know, Caligula, the let them hate so long as they fear, right? We have to recognize these are civic institutions, whether it's the NSA or whether it's CIA or whether it's the FISA court. These are civic institutions that at the end of the day, the idea is they belong to you. And I know they don't feel like that, and it's not generally how they work, but I really think that's the attitude that we collectively have to have towards these institutions. We must not be afraid of them. We own them. And only by looking at them without fear can we come from a place of strength and a place of power.
So building a little bit on the discussion just now, like about the targeting of Black Panthers, I wanted to bring up that these really valuable critiques often feel like there's a mistaken kind of novelty or universality here. If you're living in New York and you're a person of color, then you're clearly surveilled every day and you don't have concerns about getting people, getting people to care about privacy because you live in a public space that is monitored by police and arbitrary arrest is a daily fact. And I just wanted to maybe connect this more to a police and prison system that's been rapidly growing for the last few decades. Wonder how you would talk about that, and also maybe like caution as we talk about connecting our struggles and about activism going forward. You know, a language that's rhetorically rooted in the Constitution and upholding our freedom tends to be one that I would want to shy away from, because the Constitution, while in some way comes out of revolutionary act against imperialism, is also an imperialist project that denied many, many of their own equal rights.
I'll just answer it this way simply. I get that. I'm going to answer that directly, having taken the oath four times, support and defend the Constitution. The Constitution is full of contradictions, okay? And it itself was formed by elites, the landed owners, right? So the question I will respond with is, what's the best way to govern ourselves? That's the fundamental question. You answer that one, you answer that question, because that's the question that James Madison was forced to face in the winter of 1986. What's the best form of governance for the people? You answer that one. Now, I tend to side with Thomas Jefferson. He who is best governed is least governed. In fact, I would argue that there's an inverse proportional relationship between the degree that we allow others to govern ourselves versus us governing ourselves, the degree to which others govern ourselves. You find the magic solution there, okay, then you're on to something. All I know is what I've experienced and what's been happening in this country, right? And if that's not a future I'm going to agree with or accept. There is something in the universal space of who we are as human beings that far exceeds all forms of governance, and that's really in the natural law space. Those truly are the inalienable rights. That's the space.
I don't think there are magical solutions or universal ones. It's about building political solidarity.
Yeah. But how do you do that? Because obviously it's not working right now in this country, okay? It's not working. If it was working, we'd have a different form of governance. I'm just going to throw it right back at you. What future are you going to create, okay?
Yeah.
Beyond what you know or what you see, okay? That's the fundamental question you must address at the deepest personal level in partnership with others. Because that's what you'll create for yourself. If it matters to you, that's the future you'll see. That's the future you'll live from.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I wrote a book about the rendition program in secret prisons that came out in the early 2000s, and at talks there, I would say, you know, this is just really a prison system that's like, you know, we have Guantanamo Bay over there, but we've had this thing called Pelican Bay in California since the mid-1980s. It was the same exact thing, it's just in California, and that was a little, people didn't really want to hear it at that point, but absolutely. The prison system in particular, since the 1970s, has been, you know, one of the major civic enterprises in terms of constructing a part of the state. It happens more at the state level than at the federal level, but absolutely, that has been the solution to income inequality, to racial disparity, to the lack of a social safety net. It has been the construction of a prison system that now, which very disproportionately targeted working class people, modestly educated people, people of color. That system, I think, has now been generalized to the entire world. We're living in this kind of everywhere war on terror world. And that, to me, is why, in the article and here today, I'm advocating for, it's not just a matter of, let's put some checks and balances on what Facebook can do. Let's, rein in the NSA in terms of who they can surveil and what they can do with the data. I think it's a much more fundamental question about building civic institutions that we want to live with in the future. I disagree with the idea that the best thing to do is just tear down every aspect of the government, because that's just not, we live in a capitalist society. If we do that, then, whatever, Apple and, Exxon are gonna just run anything. So I think there is a role for the state, because the state is the part of the society that ostensibly we can collectively sculpt and shape, and we have to think about what kind of state we want to live in and actively work towards that. We have to think about what does security
mean to us? What are the sources of insecurity that we feel? Are we really worried about terrorism, or are we more worried about losing our job? Are we more worried about losing healthcare? And I think that's the kind of society that we have to imagine. That's the only way I really see this thing not getting really, really, really bad.
Okay, I think we'll end it on that optimistic note. thank you, everyone.